Lovely to be here with you, Debbie. Thanks so much for the opportunity to have this chat today.
It's great to be here too, Mark. Thanks for suggesting it.
Well, we do a lot of conversations in the background, don't we, about all the different factors that help people to thrive, to be at their professional best, and also to protect their cognitive resources and mental health. Today, Debbie and I are talking about autonomy and intrinsic drive in the context of the Aspire Index. But putting aside the context for one moment, what is it about autonomy and intrinsic drive that make up really significant, quite protective factors when it comes to our capacity to focus, perform, and be well? Gosh, with that very broad introduction, Deb, where would you like to start?
I think that when I think about these two factors which make up the cluster, so autonomy and intrinsic drive, I'm always intrigued how closely they're tied together, but you wouldn't necessarily always think of that. So for example, for me, I think autonomy often speaks quite loudly to people, like they want to have some kind of power and ability to choose how they do something, not just what they do. But it's looking at the science, then really fascinating to see how much that autonomy plays a part in developing intrinsic drive. So the real desire to do something and how you can look at where if you're very heavily directed to do something, your motivation or your drive to do it might be lower because that's sort of an extrinsic force saying you must do this. So to me, it's interesting thinking about how two things that we've obviously put together in the same cluster because we've got the science tells us that they're very closely related, but it's not always obvious in our day-to-day lives how much they are connected.
Well, that's a really good point. And they're mutually reinforcing, aren't they? But perhaps before we delve further down into that for our listeners, autonomy, agency, started down the pathway here, Debbie. Thank you for describing what that looks like in terms of the reasons or why people are naturally attracted towards autonomy. Might be worth just spending a moment talking about the linkages between autonomy and agency and healthy team collaborative environments, because we do know that autonomy, when we ratchet that up, it is a protective factor for mental health and has been shown to help lower psychosocial risks, including in relation to job overload and potentially downstream burnout risks. Increase someone's autonomy, they have a greater sense of control. And we all like that, don't we? In terms of, we're all members of that special club called Control Freaks International. When we're deprived of that, perhaps not such a great thing to be deprived of that, is it? Look, for those listening, just exploring for the first time, perhaps what that looks like, have a think about some of those times when you are deprived of the control over simple little things like how and when you get a job done versus whether you need to get it done. Because often we don't have choice about the bigger picture things, but the how we go about that, you know, it replies to a lot of areas of life. Debbie, I know that you went to the gym this morning, for instance. If someone said to you, right, you've got to get fit and it's got to be this and you've got to be there at that time and you have no choice, how does that impact on the likelihood that you'll do it and be intrinsically driven to go and do it?
I would say that makes the chances very low. I've always said I would be a very poor member of the armed forces. But I happen to like going to the gym, so I go. But this is that's just a way of exercising, as you pointed out, that is something that appeals to me, therefore I'm driven to go.
And you've got choice around when
and
where. So apply that to other work sort of situations. We've got a job to do. We've all got jobs or processes that we need to undertake to fulfill certain outcomes as part of our contract with the world at large or our employer or our firm. So that's sort of largely we can influence but can't necessarily control, but we can, of course, ratchet up those aspects where we can have a say or give someone a say for leaders listening over how and when you might get the job done. And this helps promote autonomy. So What are some of the research points telling us now, Debbie, about autonomy in the legal profession? We're sort of getting quite a lot of Aspire Index results mm-hmm. back in, and you know, we know that, you know, well, for those of you who didn't know, Debbie has a law degree. I used to be a lawyer. We kind of relate to this construct of you know, wanting high control over processes and outcomes. What are we learning from the Aspire Index results?
I think something on the autonomy front that I found very interesting from our results so far is the relationship between autonomy and some other outcomes that we look at in Aspire. So we look at measures of career satisfaction, but we also look at occupational self-efficacy. So occupational self-efficacy being how well you really believe, the kind of confidence that you have in your ability to do your job. Mm. And we're seeing a really nice correlation between autonomy and intrinsic drive and occupational self-efficacy. And so that's really showing to me that if you're able to have that kind of input, I suppose, not necessarily control, but that kind of input and influence over how you complete something, that actually improves or is connected to your belief in how well you can do that. Mm. And this is something I think that is not only interesting for individuals, but for leaders, right? So yeah. I think we're in a time now where, and we've talked about this a lot, about how you have cognitive flexibility, but also the flexible working environment. And there's, and we're kind of at that as a sort of a point where people are starting to think, how much flexibility should we give people? Mm. And I think we probably can err to on the side of having too much flexibility, because that then starts to kind of become overloading. And we'll talk about that, I'm sure, in another yeah. conversation later.
No rails, no guidelines. You exactly. just sort of set adrift. Yeah.
But I think it's interesting to think about how giving people this autonomy, or allowing people to have some kind of influence over how they do things, actually improves their self-efficacy and their confidence in how they can do their job, which usually correlates with doing the job well and high right. performance.
Performance goes up when you are deprived of your, you know, feeling imprisoned in your work. You're not going to perform that well. And it is known and recognized as a protective factor in terms of mental health in the workplace, which of course correlates with, we know, performance outcomes too. So the business case is pretty clear. What about, so we clustered intrinsic drive together, and you've mentioned, mm-hmm. which I really, this is a fascinating topic of how our autonomy can feed into our intrinsic drive, our sort of ability to tap into the reason why I might just put that extra discretionary effort into something. Should we talk about that, and perhaps even how that might work in reverse in terms of the interplay between autonomy and some of the things that make me intrinsically driven and interested in doing that little bit extra?
Absolutely. And I think this is something I would love to hear your thoughts on, sort of what in the brain is happening when you're intrinsically driven versus mm. having that external motivation. I think external motivation, as we know, can like vary from all types of things, from carrots to sticks to nagging, yeah. to reminders to nudges, etc. But what's the difference inside the brain? Why does it actually push us that little bit further to have that intrinsic mm. motivation?
Mm. Great question. So if you have somebody, and we used this example at the beginning of our chat today, Debbie, about your love for the gym. If we had somebody say to you suddenly, no, you have to go, and you have to go to this gym, and it's a different one, and at a different time, and you're required to do that. We talked about how that would negatively impact on your drive, your motivation to do it. So we know that you can overdo organizational and leadership pushes to motivate people, and it can have an inverse impact. So mm-hmm. what does intrinsic drive and motivation look like? Well, we know that there are certain neurochemicals playing a big role here, and one of them is dopamine, and often people talk about dopamine is the reward neurochemical. Mm-hmm. It sort of is, but it doesn't quite capture its primary impact. So the idea of getting a reward because the organization said, do this and you'll get this reward, goes some part of the way, provided the thing that the person is going to get is mm-hmm. so deeply meaningful and purposeful to them that it drives up dopamine to get there. Now, here's the thing about dopamine. If you take a general sample of individuals in any population, let's just keep this in the law firm environment, mm-hmm. and you test out when dopamine is at its highest. Let's look at, say, completion of an M&A deal. Mm-hmm. The dopamine actually is at its highest when the deal is about to complete, generally across the population of the lawyers and their clients. Dopamine's really high when we're about to sign and there's high fives and then it hits its peak. And then everyone thinks, I'm going to be so happy once that's over. But then suddenly the dopamine drops as soon as mm-hmm. that achievement is attained. The dopamine generally drops. And so the reward, if you like, if we're looking at dopamine as a reward neurochemical, it's very motivating. It's very exciting. It helps ignite other processes in the brain, including prefrontal cortex activity, where our capacity to think straight, focus, concentrate, be creative, all resides, and also helps along the way serotonin, the happy hormone. So we look at that. The actual motivation, if we equate dopamine to motivation, is in the lead up to and the final stages of the achievement, hitting that finishing line. I'm about to cross it. So therefore, it's much more of a motivation neurochemical than it is a reward neurochemical, because it hits its peak when you're about to achieve that thing, when you're just crossing the finishing line. So it's the chasing of that dopamine. It's a little bit like when you're scrolling on social media or news and bam, there's another bit of news. It's the anticipation of that bam that creates the dopamine burst that keeps us going and looking for that new thing. Once it's there, the dopamine drops and you're not feeling that great. You're not really that satisfied. So to cut a short story long, Debbie, I see this as a motivation neurochemical that relates very much to what really matters to you. And of course, it can be socially infectious. Mm. And so a little bit like anxiety, when you're in a group where someone's fearful and anxious, you might pick up on that and you're likely to start to carry that yourself. That excitement towards something can be infectious, and the dopamine effect can happen in a team, but it's far less likely it will happen because an organization says, if you do this, we'll all be better off and go and do it. It's much more likely to come with it, that intrinsic drive and some autonomy.
Fantastic. And so with that, knowing that, what's the best way for us to be able to help ourselves generate that? I'm not talking about sort of amping ourselves up every 5 minutes, but how can we tap into that motivational effect of dopamine? Are there any tips and tricks that we can use?
I think great question. Self-awareness and insight, really, and insight into, when does that happen for me? When do I feel my greatest excitement levels when I'm about to achieve something? What are the things, that the conditions that led me to achieve that? Were they mm-hmm. environmental, social, group stuff that makes me get excited and I'm going to drive this for the team? Is it a combination of that and perhaps something else that's deeply meaningful to me that excites me? Yeah. Does it go all the way back to my childhood? And, you know, I've always loved puppy dogs, as you know, Debbie. So I get great joy and the anticipation of joy and the dopamine burst of out of puppy dogs. So I used to go and volunteer at a dog mm-hmm. Adoption agency. Yeah. And you know, just arriving there, I would get this burst of dopamine. It's wonderful. Driving home, it was a bit like, meh, done now. So understanding yourself, and for us as well, when we are developing research together and looking at results of surveys like the Aspire Index, you and I get this sort of thrill of discovery, and that motivates us. So we know that about ourselves, and we reflect on that together. So the two things are, I guess, some interoceptive awareness, tapping into when do I feel like that? What are the patterns? And some social feedback with this. You know, we are social creatures. When do you see me most excited? And I know that I can answer that with you, and we probably can with each other quite a bit. And what can I learn from that? And how will that help me to drive more of my behaviors towards the things and put my focus towards the things that build upon that? Meaning and purpose plays a big role, and what I value plays a big role. And this is where we see a lot of the Aspire Index factors or clusters really feeding into each other. So I know what I value, which is what means a lot to me and helps me to feel like a good person, and what stimulates me and makes me happy. They're the things that will give me intrinsic drive. And when I'm operating with autonomy, hey, we're sort of humming on, can we say 12 cylinders anymore when we're really looking more at electric cars now? Anyway. You know what
we know what we mean.
We know what we mean. What about you? And what's your perception on this? Because you do a lot of research, and you look at the interoperability of all of these factors too. Love to hear your thoughts.
I think I was just, as you were talking then, I was thinking, okay, this is really, you know, we're obviously starting with autonomy and intrinsic drive, but as the discussion goes along, it's really becoming obvious how important it is to recognize that all of the Aspire clusters support and develop each other. And what you were just saying there about purpose and values alignment, and like really tapping into something that is meaningful to you as being something which then becomes an intrinsic driver, is something which I think is a great starting point. So that's what struck me. And so sometimes we can think, it can feel when we're busy or we're overwhelmed, that we don't feel motivated. It's then being able to actually use that interoceptive awareness, self-regulate, and then stop and think, oh, hang on a second. What am I working towards? What are the things that matter to me most? And how can I use those things in these moments to actually move me forward? And bringing, if we want to bring in more of the factors, like we think about pro-social, obviously, which I think we'll come to in much more depth later, but it's about offering help to others, having that support that you're offering. But I think there's also an element of that where there has to be the reciprocal receipt of support. So it's actually recognizing that you can actually gain strength from having others help you. And this has been in the back of my mind since we began this conversation about autonomy. So maybe we can come full circle back to how important it is for people to have that ability to influence how they do things for themselves and have that bring their autonomy into their work. I'm really interested in thinking about how we can manage that as leaders when we have many autonomous individuals who might want to all do things differently.
How can we
allow that flexibility for people to demonstrate and use their autonomy to drive them forward without creating anarchy and chaos?
It's a bit of a meta question there, isn't there? Because I'm thinking, you know, part of the solution here, or part of the answer ideally, would be give the team members autonomy to work together to decide on the answer to that question.
Exactly.
I came across an example recently as well that could be helpful in terms of clustering, where we listen to, and when we feel heard, and these are my preferences, and the ways in which then we're clustered together on jobs with other people who work similarly or in a complementary way, is a response to your individual preferences. So that's driving up agency and autonomy. I hear you, and I'm going to put you in this group of people who like to do things similarly. And the example I was thinking of was in the context of AI adoption and exploring what works and exploring new ways of using AI, which we know is a wonderful pathway for teams to go on, rather than having a one way of doing things, to actually explore individual preferences and then form clusters. So there might be people in your team who the last thing they want is to be told you have to go and join a group where you're going to do a think tank together and all in a room, and they just want to go away and work quietly on their own and come up with some ideas and then bring them back to the group, perhaps. Mm-hmm. So forming these little clusters of people who like to do everything together in a group, let's form those little think tanks and have workshops, and others who might like to go and work on their own and then come back and group together, to actually get them to decide how they group together and what that looks like, rather than this is an example of whether they group together and come back, because that's the non-negotiable. But the negotiable is how and when. And then to put to the group, is there anyone in the middle here? How would that work for you? Is there, what do we think about there being a third group somewhere in the middle that's a bit of a hybrid? And then, you know, take that autonomy and agency further. You get the groups working together, you experiment and explore, and then you ask everyone, so how's that working for you? How do you mm-hmm. think we could refine this? Would you like a fourth cluster or to shift clusters because you've learned something about yourself? And this is all driving up autonomy and in terms of how we get the job done, not whether.
Mm-hmm.
So there's an example, and that's intrinsically more motivating. The other thing I should say about this is when we get to a result, the power of that reward is so important for behavioral reinforcement, but not because, as we've discussed, the huge dopamine hit comes after you've done something. It's not because of that. The reward mechanism lights up the dopamine pathways for future behavior relating to the same thing. So, oh, I'll get a dopamine hit. You're not conscious of it. I'll do that again. I'll get a dopamine hit knowing I'm going to do that again and this feels really good and there'll be a reward. So the dopamine goes up, the reward mechanism reinforces it rather than creates that big dopamine hit. So we've got so much to talk about, haven't we, as always. Before we, because I just want to also, Debbie, point out for our listeners as well, we'll be having further discussions. And after mm-hmm. this one, the next episode will be on pro-social and what that looks like, how it intersects with all of the other factors. But we did mention, and this is something to look out for as well for future episodes, a deep dive into interoceptive awareness. For those listeners who are curious about that, spoiler alert, Debbie, what are we talking about here?
What we're really talking about is our ability to notice signs in our body. So are you feeling very sort of, can you feel a knotty feeling in your stomach? Are you starting to get really aching, stressed shoulders? And actually noticing these signs and thinking, taking a moment to say, oh, what is this telling me about my mental state? I love the way, and the reason we need to do this, we need to take notice of these sort of like physical sensations in our body to help us connect with our mental state, is because, and I love the way you put this, Mark, is that we don't have these kind of pain nerve endings in our brain. So if you're cognitively overloaded, you don't suddenly get a pain in your head the way that you would get a pain in your ankle if you...
Yeah, you don't go, oh, there's my ventromedial prefrontal cortex itching or tickling or little spike, because you don't get that pain deep inside your brain.
Exactly. But
so what you're saying is your body's going to tell you. Right?
Yeah, that your body's going to tell you. And if you can take note of these things, you can take very, very small, easy steps to self-regulate, which is the other part of the cluster, which then, again, as we've touched on earlier in this conversation, feeds in your ability to take action in other ways.
Nice. Nice. Thanks, Debbie. I am thinking, in terms of the linkages, to wrap up here, one of the keys to understanding my intrinsic drive, what will motivate me, and where is my autonomy best expressed for leaders, how can I engage this conversation with my team members? One of the things that strikes me about interoceptive awareness is that we can also tap into, just as the body keeps the score on stress levels, you might get a headache, but it won't be coming from deep inside your brain necessarily. It'll be the nerve endings in your skull and around that pick up on these things. But when you're excited, when you think, oh, yes, I want to throw myself into that project like you and I often do together, Where do we feel that as a clue to what motivates me, as a clue to what it feels like when I got a dopamine hit? What kinds of things would I look out for? Should we pop a couple in just before we finish up on this conversation, Debbie? And also, just a reminder, come back and have a listen to the deeper dive on this. Where does that show up for you?
I have that feeling, which I guess it can be. I think this is the one thing that's so important about really tapping in and being very, it's dialing up your awareness if you can, because sometimes the feelings of excitement and anticipation aren't that different from the feelings of anxiety, right? If you think sometimes you might get a bit of a knotty feeling in your stomach if you're a bit anxious about something, but you might also get like a little bump or a lift or butterflies in your stomach if actually you want to tap into that nervous excitement. So for me, the key thing is that the two sides of the different sides of the coin are actually, you know, they're quite close together. And for me, I think that's also something that we can look into much more deeply about how we can convert those anxious feelings into more positive feelings. And because they're so closely connected, for me anyway, physically, that makes it something that makes more sense to me.
Nice. Yeah, I'm just picturing that jittery feeling in the tummy and the story we tell ourselves about that. So the first thing is to notice, oh, I'm feeling that sort of butterfly in the tummy feeling. And is this, what are the other signs? Am I having racing thoughts about bad things, anxiety, or am I otherwise showing some signs of being excited? For me, that might mean that I'm actually really focused on something and concentrating really well. My thoughts are gathering really nicely. So there might be a dual clue there. You know, the jitters in the tummy. I was quite interested to read something about this. A university professor was talking about how she was on a date with somebody and she was sitting realizing, oh, I'm feeling really jittery in the tummy. This feels like I might be falling in love. And she goes off into the bathroom, takes a moment. She looks herself in the mirror and her eyes are dilated, pupils are dilated. She's like, oh, these are all the signs of love. So she goes back thinking, what a wonderful date. And then she goes home and suddenly feels terribly sick, breaks out in a sweat and starts vomiting. And then she realized it was a bad curry that she ate. And she was telling herself all these stories about. So beware of these things. We're looking for a few signals at once, aren't we?
We are. But also,
am I excited, anxious, or did I just eat a bad curry? There we go. These and other remarkable brain and mind insights we shall be exploring and sharing. So, Debbie, this is just to wrap up, been a wonderful conversation. Thank you about autonomy and intrinsic drive. A few top tips. Have a look in the reading notes to this podcast and you'll see a few tips for how to tap into some of these intrinsic drive indicators in yourself, but also how to play to autonomy. And sometimes it's just the simple things about how and when would you like to get that done, knowing that it does need to be done, and really drive up agency and be a big protective factor.
That's brilliant. Thanks, Mark. I really enjoyed our conversation.